Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Is globalization as we've known it coming to an end? Can Trump's massive tariff policy reindustrialize America and reinvigorate the West? At this point, it's anyone's guess. One thing is for sure, there's going to be a lot of pain for a lot of people. Cross-talking Trump's tariffs, I'm joined by my guest, Michael Hudson, in New York. He is a professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, as well as author of Forgive Them Their Debts. In Washington, we have Thomas Paley. He is a founder of the Economics for Democratic and Open Societies Project. And in St. Petersburg, we have Radhika Desai. She is a visiting professor at the Department of International Development at the London School of Economics. All right, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Michael, let me go to you first in New York. Can you explain what's going on with Trump's policy on tariffs? Because I have gotten about 72 hours of pure emotion without much analysis, and people just with their hair on fire. I guess they lost money in the stock market, which most of us don't have a dime in. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, you mentioned globalization, and Trump has his own view of globalization. Instead of having a single set of rules that all the different countries are going to be subject to, most favored nation trading, he said, we're going to negotiate on a country-by-country basis. And Trump has announced his plan. America has to come out the winner on any deal he does with another country. And the new form of globalization is designed to keep the United States at the center, and he's going to deal on a country-by-country basis. Well, everybody was terrified of his the high tariffs that he imposed last Thursday at 4 o'clock, right after the stock market closed. But then he said, well, this is just my asking point. I always ask for the moon, and my strategy, Donald Trump said, is to threaten other countries to destabilize their economy. It's the only thing that America has to offer. If the United States is deindustrialized is running a budget deficit as it is, the only thing that it can do to for other countries to offer them is not to hurt them. So Trump's negotiation with every country for its tariff is, we will disrupt your trade with the United States, and that's going to lead to unemployment there. What will you give us if we don't do that? Will you let us buy some of your raw materials or maybe your electric utilities? Each country, he's going to say, we want something for it, and then write down the tariffs. Well, Canada has stood up to this and said, well, we're calling your bluff. We're not going to offer you something and beg to, oh, please don't do us for 25 cents a percent tariff, because we realize that Trump's tariffs are basically hurting the American firms itself. And what he doesn't realize is how many imports the United States makes from its own firms abroad. So he's talked about Vietnam, which has some of the highest tariffs at all. Well, all the shoe companies in America, Adidas and the others, have their shoes made in Vietnam, and there's no way in which they can suddenly shift factories to the United States.
Michael, that's what I've been wondering here. Let me go to Thomas here. Is that how is this going to reindustrialize the United States? I guess it might, but what about the time frame? I mean, you just can't set up a shoe factory overnight in 90 days. I mean, that's one of the things I don't understand. I understand the theory, I guess, behind it. But Thomas, will it work? Go ahead.
No, the first thing to pick up from where Michael was, one has to realize that above all, this is a power play as much as it is an economic play. Trump, yes, his style is different from what went before, but he's still working with the same economic model. Globalization was designed to set up a global imperial economic system with the US at the apex and then others below it. It's a bit of a feudal system in a way. They're not all equal. Some are nobles in the system, but others are serfs, and you have to understand it. And this Trump has really ratcheted the game up, but this has been in play with O'Biden, with the Clintons, with Bush, Obama? I can't confuse O'Biden. And Trump is ratcheting up that game, and he's going to force countries to do what the U.S. wants. So deindustrialization is actually, in some ways, just rhetoric. It's partly selling it to the disenchanted, very discontented, very unhappy American working class. They are not the beneficiaries of this. Michael's already referred to it. You start tariffs, drive up prices. They're going to take a huge wage cut, and there probably won't be very much in the way of industrial gain. The uncertainty, et cetera, is undermining investment. The interruption of supply chains means that not so many jobs will come back. But nor does Trump and the American elite really want that. They don't really want to reindustrialize America. Why do you want to bring textile production back or shoe production back? You don't. And even if you did, there wouldn't be many jobs because of automation and robotics now. What they want to do is control those production systems that have high value and those that are strategically powerful. And that's the way that they will then exert control over the rest of the world. And as part of that, they will actually stop others from acquiring those systems. And that, in the past, we always shared scientific knowledge because that was good for the global economy. Technology was shared. The American system, for 30 years, has been very clear about this. We don't share. We charge you, and if it's valuable, we won't even give you access to it. And Trump is playing that game. And there are only two people in the world who understand this. That's President Putin and President Xi. And that's why China and Russia are very well positioned in this conflict, and the others are struggling. The Europeans are drowning in their own stupidity.
Well, I gave up on Europe a long time ago, so we don't have to worry about them, okay? Radhika, so who are the winners and who are the losers here? Because I can see all kinds of people on both sides of the ledger, depending on how you interpret all this. Go ahead.
Well, I think that we know who are the losers. I mean, I agree with what Tom said, which is that China is very well prepared for it. China can take this shock and weather it, which is why China is standing up to Trump, no holds barred. Who are the losers? The losers are precisely those people who gave Trump his victory. Yes. He is making all this song and dance about tariffs, not because he cares about reindustrializing the United States, not because he cares about the people who voted for him and wishes them to have better jobs. The fact of the matter is that Trump is saying all these things about tariffs only in order to beguile them into thinking that he is addressing their problems. But in reality, reindustrialization will not happen. The uncertainty is one thing, as Tom mentioned. The other thing is reindustrialization requires not just tariffs, but a real industrial policy, which Trump has no trace. Trump manifests no trace of having one. An industrial policy would require sectoral tariffs, not blanket tariffs.
Yes.
For those sectors which are being prioritized for reindustrialization. There is no evidence of that. Industrial policy would require telling American CEOs what to do,
right,
not taking orders from them, which is kind of what Trump will be doing. So for all of these reasons, the losers will be ordinary people paying high prices and so on. Meanwhile, people like Trump and the rich people in the United States are not affected by this. So what do they really care how much eggs cost or how much shoes cost or how much butter cost? They don't. So this is the key. But I'd also like to say one other thing. Trump is following, as I agree, Trump is following the same policy, but at the same time, the globalization that America has pursued has never cared about American working people or the American economy. They have only cared about creating an economy in which the United States dollar system is capable of skimming off value produced everywhere else, whether it's by American workers or by producers abroad. And this, but however, the crisis consists in the fact that the U.S. ability to do this is radically weakening, which is weakening the economy.
Weakening the United States or the system.
Weakening the U.S. productive economy, as well as weakening the financial system's ability to suck value out of the rest of the world.
Okay, all right.
This is because China has advanced. Now, Tom also mentioned that there is some element of trying to preserve technological supremacy, but the United States is manifestly unable to do that. Number one, DeepSeek. Exhibit A is DeepSeek. Exhibit B is hypersonic missiles. The United States spends trillions of dollars on its military industrial complex, and they cannot even produce what China and Russia have already produced. Exhibit three, the Australian Science Strategic Research, whatever institute, the ASPI critical technology tracker, has shown that compared to 20 years ago, the lead in technology has shifted completely in favor of China. China dominates more than 57 of the major 64 technologies they are tracking. The U.S. only a handful. And this is a complete turnaround from this situation.
But Radhika, is Trump's plan going to work? Is it going to make America richer and stronger?
No, it's not going to make America richer and stronger, because in order to make America richer and stronger, you need an industrial policy. That's how China has become rich and strong. That's how any economy that has historically become rich and strong, whether you're talking about Germany, you're talking about the Soviet Union, you're talking about Japan, any country. You know, Ross Perot back in the early 90s ran on election saying, look, yep, the Japanese have done it. How come we can't? We need industrial policy. That's what he ran on. So that's what has been always at the core of what has been.
Well, Radhika, we're going to go to a break real quick here. But Radhika, I mean, if I can glean what you've been saying, it's going to make a few individuals very, very wealthy, but no country will become more wealthy as a result.
I think the United States will not become wealthy. I think China will continue to become wealthy. I think countries that are able to take the right lessons from China.
Okay, all right. I have to jump in here. We have to go to a hard break. And after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on Trump's tariffs. Stay with RT. Okay, let's go back to Michael in New York. In my introduction, I asked the rhetorical question, is this the end of globalization? And all three of you have convinced me it's not. It's just a different kind of globalization led by the United States and maybe some of its Western allies. So this is a new globalization. It's not the end of it.
That's right. But also, it's not really about tariffs at all. It's about tax cuts in the United States. What Trump wanted above all is to cut taxes, and that meant basically cut government and the role of the government way back. He had he's been talking to people for years, and he said, well, you know, when did this income tax begin? How do I get rid of it? And somebody told him that before 1913, America didn't have an income tax.
Right.
It had all the entire government was funded by tariffs, and a little bit of the land sales for what was grabbed from the Indians. And Trump said, tariffs? Well, that's wonderful. Just imagine, tariffs fall on the employers, on the working class, on the wage earners. Tax cuts fall on my constituency, the wealthy class. If we can go back to the world the way it was before World War I and not have an income tax and just have tariffs, then there will be a whole tax shift off my constituency, the billionaires, onto U.S. labor. Well, you can imagine what this is going to do to the squeeze in the United States, where I think half of the American wage earner class hasn't been able to increase its wealth at all since 2008. All the increase in wealth in America has accrued, the stock market wealth, the bond market, the financial wealth has accrued to the top 10%. So when we're talking about globalization and who's doing it and who's America, this is a plan of the 10% to increase its position at the cost of The employment.
Michael, I mean, how much wealth can you extract from these people? I mean, well, they don't have much to take. You can't take much from them now. They don't have much. I mean, that's why I find this really quite bizarre in many ways. Let me go to Thomas here. Thomas, I understand America built it itself with tariffs. OK, and in principle, I'm not against tariffs to protect industries, sectors of it. But America's been hollowed out. What are they protecting?
No, as I said right at the beginning, this is a power play where they're punishing others. They're using tariffs to punish others and thereby force them to do what they want. And by the way, when we talk about is this the beginning or end of globalization, Trump, as I said before, is continuing with an existing model of globalization. But now the cat is out of the bag. And that's why I think it's actually the end of neoliberal globalization. Think what neoliberal globalization intended. It was a single unified global system with the US at the top and others below. China and Russia are not accepting that. I think there's been a wake-up call to India on this, and they will now change. Now, the question is what comes after that? And so piece of there's going to be a move, to, I think, in some cases towards national self-sufficiency, a bit more emphasis on self-sufficiency. The BRICS is very interesting. That is a possible alternative. But as I say, there's a tremendous amount of work to be done there. No one really knows how the BRICS would work as a coherent economic whole, how they would trade with each other. And there are tremendous political problems, too. How do you get countries to cooperate? That's a bit like herding cats. And then within each country, there are the problem of the oligarchies who don't want the BRICS. In Argentina, they don't want the BRICS. The oligarchies in India don't necessarily want the BRICS. The only two places where the politics are in place to make it work are Russia and China, where they've told the oligarchs, go out and be productive, make profits, but you are answerable to the states. And that is, by the way, what caused the U.S. to call the deal off. But we don't know what's going to happen in Europe. The Europeans seem to be happy being the satraps of the U.S., to be their servants. And in other countries, there's not much choice. What can Colombia do? It exports coffee and flowers to the United States and doesn't have much independence. So the world is now going to go through a stage of looking for alternatives. And this is a time when I hope Russia and China will really step up to the plate, as they have been doing, and point the direction and help countries move to some independence. If the Europeans could get their political act together, and you've given up on that, and I haven't totally given up on that, at some what is happening is stuff is dropping down below. European workers are understanding that it's not working, but the political system is logjammed. All the parties buy into this ideology. The Social Democrats, Labour, Conservatives, Macron, they're all the same on globalization. And so the system is going to have to be swept aside in some way. And how that happens is
the system is going to sweep them aside, most likely.
Yeah. There you go.
Radhika, how does the dollar play in all of this? Because it seems like this is a gambit to keep the dollar supreme. Go ahead in St. Petersburg.
Well, okay. I think the dollar is also very vulnerable. But let me come back. You know, I just want to say I very much agreed with all the facts as Thomas laid them out. But I want to integrate them in a slightly different way, a more helpful way. The word globalization has always had two very different meanings. In the United States, it means open up the rest of the world's economies so that American corporations and American commodities can find markets and outlets the whole world over, profit-making opportunities and so on. In China, it's always meant something very different. The increasing economic interdependence, not by unilateral opening up of the world economy, but rather by creating mutually beneficial agreements so that different economies can thrive and advance at the same time, a positive sum game. And I think that the latter type of globalization is about to win. This also has direct implications for what happens in Western economies, particularly in Western Europe. The second kind of globalization is good for the economy as a whole, for ordinary people. The first kind of globalization has only been good for a tiny elite. Now, that tiny elite still remains very much in power in the United States, in Canada, in Western Europe in particular. And they are trying to cling on to their power. I think, for example, the drive towards war with Ukraine is part of this. So long as there is a war going on, they can try to maintain their power a bit more easily. So I think that that's one thing. But more and more, I think countries that are either forced to or are able to, or governments that are forced to or able to see that they must work in the interests of ordinary people will shift to the other kind of globalization. In Europe and North America more generally, this shift will be a lot more difficult because the entrenched power of the elites is greater. And interestingly, Japan is somewhere poised in between. I read in the paper that Japan has secured priority tariff negotiations. Yes, so that looks as though they are bowing to the United States. But a day or two ago, what I read in the paper is that Japan and China and South Korea engaged in deep discussions about how to reorient. So I think that that will be their longer term strategy.
Well, I mean, Radhika,
of course, to obtain concessions.
You're bringing up something that I'm very curious about. I'm going to go to Michael with this here. Could we see other kinds of forms of globalization? Because Radhika already brought up Japan, South Korea, and China working together. That's very interesting because these three countries don't have a history of liking each other very much. Michael.
The imperative for other countries will be how do they become self-sufficient without the United States? For the last 50 years, from the non-aligned nations, countries have tried to find an alternative to the American-dominated system. But they couldn't because there weren't enough countries to go it alone. For the first time now, there's a critical mass. China, Russia, and the rest of Asia, they can afford to go it alone. They can afford to create a mutual interdependent trade among themselves without having to rely on the United States. So the effect of Trump's tariff policy and sanctions is to isolate the United States itself. He thinks that he's been able to isolate other countries. And what he's done is drive them all together and somehow leave the United States is the odd man out, and the loser of tariff policy will be the United States, because you asked how much more can they extract from American labor that's already so high in debt that the increase in inflation that we're going to have here is going to lead to massive defaults on credit card debt, mortgage debt, all of the debt that the population has been loaded down with all of a sudden is already at the breaking point. This pushes it over the edge.
Well, Thomas...
I think we are right now entering an interregnum where we don't exactly know what's going to happen next. There is obviously people are realizing that the system doesn't work for them. I think two countries that I've repeatedly said in this program are most advanced along this pathway are Russia and China, because there's so much that works for them. They have capacity already, industrial capacity, technological capacity, and they're also sort of a marriage made in heaven. Russia has the resources, China has the population for consumption, the manufacturing base, and is also a technological power. They can illustrate the way that can go, and they need to grow that block. But for the others, when you talk about South Korea, Japan, China, even if there's the intention to work together, and let's hope they can do it, because as you observe, historically they haven't, there's still the problem of how does that system work? How do you bring in Indonesia or the Philippines into this system? It's a very difficult problem, and that has not been worked out at all, and it would be a program in itself what that would look like. On the other side, I think Trump is going to fail.
I just want to jump in, if I may.
Okay, let
me finish the point, because it is a bit
of a... No, we're almost out of time. Well, Radhika, go ahead, real quick.
Well, very quickly, I would say that the South Korea-China-Japan relationship was actually thriving in the 70s and the 80s and into the 90s. And I think that the United States essentially saw this happening and decided to intervene and essentially grab China for itself. So unlike Germany, Japan did not have that hinterland to develop. And I think that was partly accounting for Japan's long stagnation. But I think that now the pushing together of China, Japan, South Korea could actually have the effect of restarting a tremendous productive dynamic in East Asia.
Okay, well, it's really quite interesting because Donald Trump believes, or at least he says he believes, he's doing it for the American people. But he might be doing the world a huge favor by reshuffling the deck here. That's all the time. We have a fascinating discussion. That's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Washington, New York, and in St. Petersburg. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, cross that rules.